So we're doing our next installment on a book called Marshall McLuhan's Mosaic, subtitled Probing the Literary Origins of Media Studies, written by the Italian professor Elena Lamberti in 2012.
Right, so we're up to Chapter 6, The Hyperlanguage of the Media, quote, fan. And the subtitle is Media Fan or Grammarian of Media. And Bob would say it's about McLuhan. Is he a media fan or is he a grammarian of
yeah.
the media?
Her thesis is that there are several masks of McLuhan. McLuhan the media guru, McLuhan the wearing a mask, the mask wearer, the put on, and then the retrieval of modernism or Lewis and Joyce and the vortices. Retrieving them is another mask. And then there's the uncritical celebration of any new technologies that happen. She calls that McLuhan as media fan.
Mm-hmm.
That's the chapter here, that mask of him.
Was there a mystery mask too?
No.
What are the four again?
Media guru, media fan, media mask, McLuhan the mask wearer itself, and McLuhan the vorticist.
Oh, the vorticist.
The modernist.
Right.
I wonder if we could find what page that is.
You named them all, so we don't have to wait on that. So what I would say about this chapter, it begins to be kind of repetitious. Lamberti, as any good professor, will keep repeating. And since you've described what's gone on the previous 107 pages, this chapter actually is quite repetitious, although when I read it, I clipped a lot of it. But I think just to start out, I'll read, pretty much the first page, and then we can go from there. So, media fan or grammarian of media, ? Many critics assumed that Marshall McLuhan was a fan of technology because he discussed new media all through his books. If you think of it, it is a very naive idea, which I will discuss further in part two of this volume. And let me say right now that it is also a false idea. McLuhan was not a media geek. He was not lost in technological space, or better, since he was lost in technological space, he started to question the related maelstrom, just as Poe's Mariner. And I just skipped the next bit down to the sentence. He was simply probing, new technologies, new media. Next paragraph. Well, short of the next paragraph. The mosaic has often been read as the objective correlative of McLuhan's passion for media, thereby translating his curiosity into a confused elaboration of data overload intelligible only to the media geek tribe. And then she goes into the tribe contributed to this interpretation. She argues that more than a media fan, McLuhan was a grammarian of media. Now, tell us, Bob, what does she mean by a grammarian of media?
Well, when you learn writing, pencil writing,
yep.
Learn to read, you have to learn the syntax, the connecting logic of a sentence or of letters and words and paragraphs. So that's the traditional literate meaning of grammar. You learn how to communicate in literacy,
mm-hmm.
right? So you learn the grammar of writing. He maintained that we have these new forms of communication, movies, TV, radio, and people are wallowing in them and don't know they even require a grammar to perceive correctly or holistically. They don't find out how movies are made. They just watch movies, and they're subject to the camera tricks and all that's done in the technology of the making of the movie. They have no interest in how... nobody telling them how those things happen. So they swam in the new fish without any awareness.
They swam in the new water.
Yeah, without any awareness of what the water was made up of and how it seemed to be useful to them.
Okay, so that's like
So grammar in the traditional...
Ignoring the environment. Totally ignoring the environment that they're in.
The new writing.
Yeah.
The telegraph was writing by electricity.
Right.
You know, so there's new... You know, a lot of words have photograph, telegraph. Graph was writing, letters.
Uh-huh.
So they projected the old literate media on the new environments, the new technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using these tools, participating in the communication of them, and had no clue there might be certain rules about the syntax, grammar, and constituents of the media that the consumers should be aware of.
Okay, good. So she continues, what he did was to explore the new media environment in order to find its patterns. The mosaic is, in fact, not a hypertext embedding the media fan, but a new hyperlanguage which discusses new technologies through the humanities. Now, I'm surprised. She says that right at the first paragraph, but isn't that hyperlanguage topic what Michel Mouz talks about in his PhD in his book?
Yeah, there's...
So is she taking that from Michel and not attributing yet?
Yes. Well, hyperlanguage, it's not a term that Michel Mouz invented. Hypertext comes in the 70s or in the 90s as the multi-level availability on your computer,
yeah.
The links and hypertext. So she's saying that McLuhan wrote like hypertext before hypertext showed up in the public consciousness.
Uh-huh.
The mosaic, she says, is in fact not a hypertext embedding the media fan, but a new hyperlanguage which discusses new technologies through the humanities.
So other people have used hyperlanguage.
Right. So, yeah, hypertext is used is the term in computer world. So the mosaic is not just hypertext. McLuhan is sort of showing beyond the effects of the efficient operation of hypertext and into the multimedia environment that it was part of, hypertext was part of.
Mm-hmm.
And McLuhan's mosaic is like hypertext, but she'd rather say hyperlanguage so you don't get thinking it's just limited to the hypertext phenomenon.
But calling it a language just keeps it in the literary world.
All media are languages. You're thinking of a literate version of language,
yes.
But computers, you know, Logan wrote a book, the sixth language. Computers are the sixth language, the fifth language. You know, these are new environments, and new environments are linguistic.
Great. Okay. Next paragraph. It is true that McLuhan did participate future development. It is true that McLuhan did anticipate future developments of information and communication technologies with uncanny precision. He did not envision the production of Blackberries, iPods, or iPhones, but he imagined their technological effects and anticipated the environmental side effects of the digital and interactive technologies, which we now manage on a daily basis. So then she talks about John Moss, M-O-S-S, who introduces a collection of essays of McLuhan's. And
an essay reappraising the usefulness of McLuhan.
Uh-huh.
It was a conference in Ottawa. I have the book.
Now, he has in fact pointed out this futuristic aspect of McLuhan's media investigations, and there's a colon, and then it says, Labor Day evening 2001, the CBC is rebroadcasting a mosaic of interviews from This Hour Has 7 Days, originally televised in 1966. And there is Marshall McLuhan, introduced by Patrick Watson, with the warning that only 10% of the interview makes sense, even to McLuhan. So who would have said, is that Moss saying what McLuhan said at the time?
Yeah, Moss, and his book is called, this conference in Ottawa was called At the Speed of Light, There is Only Illumination. That's probably a line from McLuhan. So all these scholars, you know, do their mea culpa and say, oh, we forgot You know, we put down McLuhan in the old days. Now we have to realize he was relevant. So McLuhan used to say back in the 60s, I don't pretend to understand my stuff.
Mm.
It's very difficult. So that statement is what Patrick Watson on CBC, who was a neighbor of McLuhan's in the Wychwood Park. Patrick Watson was a famous TV broadcaster on CBC in the 60s. He is saying to the audience, as they introduce an interview with McLuhan, that his stuff is very difficult. Even McLuhan admits it's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he quotes the line I just said.
Mm-hmm.
So John Moss is talking about this celebration of McLuhan as he introduces this collection of essays by professors on McLuhan.
Mm-hmm. And then rest of the paragraph, I guess she's saying McLuhan envisions the World Wide Web with uncanny precision.
Wait, you're not reading it.
No, I don't want to read every word. We can just highlight things.
Yeah, but you didn't get to the point here.
Okay.
This Hour of 7 Days, famous CBC show, televised in 66, they have an excerpt from McLuhan. And John Moss says, and there is Marshall McLuhan, introduced by Patrick Watson with the warning that only 10% of the interview makes sense, even to McLuhan. Make of it what you will, the Americans love him. And then McLuhan speaks about things we now take for granted and does so with clarity and wit. He does not have the terminology or the technology, but he envisions the World Wide Web with uncanny precision. He describes the present with, in 2001, with prophetic acumen, a futurist positioned by history to anticipate the past.
That's a neat line.
Yeah, his genius is confirmed not by how much his ideas now surprise, but by how little. It is like Newton and gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So back before that, he says, make of it what you will, the Americans love him.
Why does he say the Americans love him? This is a CBC Canada.
Right. I'm not sure, unless he's saying back then the Americans made him popular. They put him on a national show, NBC, gave him an hour in 67. Mm-hmm. They put him on the cover of Newsweek. He was interviewed all over the place and spoke everywhere. So Americans kind of made McLuhan famous. It's an old truism in the folklore of Canada that if you, to become a famous person in Canada, you have to go away and be famous somewhere else.
Right.
And Canadians don't like their fellow famous neighbors.
Right. So this phrase, a futurist positioned by history to anticipate the past, that sounds kind of ionic right there.
Yeah, a futurist positioned by history to anticipate the past. I don't know why she's saying the past, other than it's that many years later and people have been put through changes. They can see the medium as the message on some rudimentary level. And it's a retrospective. A futurist who now is correct about the past. But at the time, he was speaking about the future. So it's definitely an ionic statement. You know, the back then, our now was projected from the future.
Right.
Into the past then to be realized today.
Now, I just looked up the reference, and it is Moss speaking those words.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It says, in his introduction to a collection of essays dedicated to a reappraisal of Marshall McLuhan.
Right. Okay, so then in the next paragraph, just to further to this futurist position by history to anticipate the past, it says, McLuhan himself was the first to remind his audiences that he had carefully predicted only what had already happened. So that's interesting. So that's the artist looking ahead and calling it now.
Well, maybe one of the first times that was said, about 1973, Tom Wolfe, who had made McLuhan famous in American journalism in the 60s, he comes and visits McLuhan, and there's this interview in the backyard at Wychwood Park. And Wolfe begins at the beginning, pretty near the beginning, saying, you know, many things you said many years ago have come true.
Uh-huh.
And McLuhan says, yes, I'm always careful to predict what has already happened.
I see.
So that's what Moss, or she is referring to, is his famous statement that he only predicts what has already happened.
Right.
So what did you...
I'm just expanding on the theme about his predictions, but he's saying they've already happened.
I mean, and he was the first to say that about his futurism.
Right. And she or somebody gives an exclamation mark at the end of that sentence. And then continuing, but with the paradox comes a series revelation derived from the humanistic philosophical traditions, the effect always precedes the formal cause, so much so that the future can only be an invention of the past. So there. He used that a lot. The effects precede the cause. I don't know that he said formal cause, but
Well, there's four Aristotelian causes.
Uh-huh.
The material, the efficient, the final, and the formal. The formal, McLuhan says, refers to the effects on people, on the audiences of the media.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Aristotle meant it that way. If you actually look at what the words Aristotle said, I think there is a bit of fiction in McLuhan's projection on those terms. But he basically said the Gutenberg galaxy emphasized the efficient cause, which means making machines and having progress, and didn't care about the effects of technology on people. Then the electric age made humans paranoid about new technologies, and they started in an innocent way being nervous about new technologies and their effects. And then McLuhan came along to pick up on that public mood of new anxiety and turned it into a syntax, a proper, clear explanation of why the people were nervous.
Mm. Okay. So now...
Formal. So he was explaining the retrieval of formal causality in the 20th century.
Okay.
Especially through advertising.
So the next paragraph, it begins with, forget that, so I'm not even going to say that, but in that paragraph, return to Poe's Mariner and remember that as a scientist and as a prophet, McLuhan acted as someone committed to finding the hidden cause of what was already visible, what triggers the mechanism of the vortex. Where does the dynamic process of the maelstrom originate? How does it evolve? And she's quoting...
Blair Stone, yeah. One thing I wanted to say is that back when McLuhan was famous, nobody thought of him as a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
Only a few people thought of him as a prophet. And as someone, a prominent lawyer in Washington who's studying McLuhan now and brings it up a lot with his friends, he's quite shocked at how nobody knows who McLuhan is. Uh-huh. He's reading McLuhan, therefore lost in the McLuhan vortex and realized how significant McLuhan was as a scientist, as a prophet. But he's surprised how nobody knows about him today.
Mm.
And so back then, it was even worse in a way. And this is what's good about Lamberti's book, is that she dares to call him a scientist and a prophet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Though she says it's quite easy today to see that. But since nobody knows about McLuhan, they don't know this guy existed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to skip to the next subheading, because the rest of this next paragraph, she's pulling him back into the humanist tradition.
Well, the quote from Stone is, it is enough simply to recognize that the basis of McLuhan's predictiveness is his theoretical construct. Then she says this theoretical construct is rooted in the humanistic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So that's her case, that it comes from humanities.
Yeah.
Then what were you saying? You're going to go to another part.
Yeah, just continue on, because she's always going to bring it back to the literary humanism at the end of every topic. The next heading is hypertexting the mosaic. It begins with, in fact, it is not that wrong to read the potentialities of McLuhan's mosaic through the heuristic process of hypertext, especially since the newest theories on digital hypertext have convincingly discussed it as a form which enables and even fosters a convergence between technology and contemporary critical theory. To return to the previously recalled hypertext theories, which George Landau has been examining since 1982, we can in fact acknowledge that, And there's a quote. So is this
from George Landau?
Quoting George Landau, we must abandon conceptual systems founded on ideas of center margin, hierarchy, and linearity, and replace them by ones of multilinearity, nodes, links, and networks. Almost all parties to this paradigm shift, which marks a revolution in human thought, see electronic writing as a direct response to the strengths and weaknesses of the printed book, one of the major landmarks in the history of human thought.
What is she saying is the landmark? The book or hypertext?
I think I took it as the electronic writing.
See, electronic writing as a direct response, one of the major landmarks in the history of human thought. No, she's saying that's the book is the major landmark.
Okay. Electronic writing as a direct response to the strengths and weaknesses of the printed book, one of the major landmarks in the history of human thought. I suppose, yeah, major landmark. The book was long before electronic writing. Okay, but what's he saying? It's just
he's saying what McLuhan said, and this is, you know, 20 years later. In 1982, mm-hmm. He's a language professor. He's famous for analyzing metaphor. He is saying there's a change caused by computers and hypertext that's going to be really radical.
Hmm.
And Lamberti is pointing out that he's saying the change is exactly what McLuhan predicted.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, reduction of center margin structures and hierarchy and visual space and linearity, they're all going to be overlaid by the page of Finnegan's Wake, which is multilinear, many nodes and links and networks on each page of Finnegan's Wake. That's what he doesn't say. He doesn't connect it to Finnegan's Wake. But he is noticing that the computer language is not your normal Gutenberg linearity, which is not hard to take or make. So she's going to say, see, this guy, you know, 30 years later, catches up to McLuhan.
Catches up, right. Okay, so I lost my page when I was looking for the next reference. The next part I want to do is just the quote on hypertext. Can you read that? Two paragraphs down.
A quote on hypertext?
Yeah.
You mean by someone else?
By Nelson.
Yeah, Theodore Nelson, who was a friend of Mary McLuhan's eventually. He is sort of one of the early theorizers of hypertext in California.
Mm.
So he did a book called Literary Machines, and he theorizes hypertext as an interactive system based on a discontinuous form focused on the user's freedom, another way to describe Finnegan's Wake. So he says, by hypertext, I mean non-sequential writing, text that branches and allows choices to the reader best read at an interactive screen. As popularly conceived, this is a series of text chunks connected by links which offer the reader different pathways. So Don Thiel and McLuhan would point out, if McLuhan read this, he said, they don't know that it was already done by James Joyce. And that McLuhan was translating James Joyce ahead of everybody.
And was it Thiel that hypertexted Ulysses?
He just typed it up and put it online.
Oh, okay.
And he was able to do that in Canada because the Joyce's estate, run by his grandson Stephen, had no control over Canada in the copyright world.
Oh.
He had control over the United States, but not Canada. So Don, a professor in Ontario, Canada, took advantage of that and put Finnegan's Wake out online. And I don't think Stephen liked that.
No, I don't imagine. Yeah. The next paragraph, just a few lines in. In practice, hypertext is an updated version of Bush's Memex, M-E-M-E-X, a neologism combining the ideas of memory and index, a device conceptualized as early as 1945.
Yeah, Vannevar Bush is a famous American scientist who was headed up many advanced committees. And his understudy was Donald Trump's uncle. And Donald Trump's uncle's the guy who explored Tesla, was the archivist for Tesla Works. He also was a big student of Vannevar Bush, who's the famous early thinker about what computer language is going to be.
Mm.
And he came up with the term MEMEX, M-E-M-E-X.
And then she goes on to say, however, if it had been presented to King Thalmas as a gift to improve our memory or thought, quite certainly the MEMEX would have prompted the same judgment that he pronounced when Thruath introduced...
When Thoth, that's Thoth, actually.
That's Thoth.
Yeah.
Ah.
Spelled differently.
Yeah. When Thoth introduced the invention of writing to him. And that's the famous story of King Thalmas. When any invention came along, he killed the inventor.
Yeah.
And we've not done that. That's what North America is famous for, or the West is famous for, just accepting any new invention without any research or any...
And that's the effect of the Gutenberg galaxy. The printing press blinded us to looking at the effects, because the effects is looking at reality as a sphere, and things are connected and reverberate off each other. When you get the eyeball enhanced into limited visual perspective and distance and... not noticing the other sensory dynamics, like the spherical nature of acoustic space, you do not notice the rebounding. You do not notice the effects. And you start making an ideology of progress. And that's heightening efficient causality, making better and better machines, and ignoring the formal causality effects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that created a counter-environment. You know what the counter-environment to the hyper of efficient causality? It was humanist art, poetry, novels, painting, music. These guys or women would write texts trying to retrieve formal causality. They would say, look at what this technology is doing to people. So the drama of novels and anything else in our art history is the answer to the new ground of efficient causality taking over, and the studying the effects, because they are visually blind to the whole effects around them with their narrow visual perspective,
mm-hmm.
and looking just at the horizon and getting to a new goal orientation, that meant that the artist was in a second-class citizen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so...
They got in the way of progress.
Right. Going toward the end of the paragraph.
Now, this thought story is a famous story in Plato.
Do you want to read it? Or
No. And
no.
And Thoth presents his invention to the pharaoh, so I guess in this case King Thamus.
Mm-hmm.
And Thamus says, no, this will create forgetfulness in learners' souls.
Right. Thoth was trying to present writing. And then the words here toward the end of this paragraph. Thalmas warned Thoth, people would instead become more and more ignorant, relying on writing to bring things to their remembrance through external signs. People would lose the capability of looking through things to participate in the process of learning. They would have the show of wisdom without the reality. And then Lamberti continues, if my parallel stands, then the memex is to memory as writing is to orality. The point now is to decide if McLuhan's probes relate more to writing and memex or to memory and orality. My idea is that being verbi-vocal-visual tools, the probe's substance is closer to the latter pair, even though their function may recall the one offered by links in hypertext. So, what do you make of all those words?
Well, the oral pre-writing nature of the pharaoh, of the king, they see effects. They still have formal causality in their world. They don't have categories like Aristotle creates in the era of the phonetic alphabet in Greek literature. But before that, tribal oral people naturally can see the effects of any new invention. So it was a cliche back then to kill any inventor. You know, they knew that it would upset their society and power structure.
Mm-hmm.
We lost that once we got embedded in the rabbit hole of the effects of the printing press the last 400 years, 500 years. So then Thoth is told that by the king that it will affect people's memory.
Mm-hmm.
So then Lamberti is asking, will this new hypertext or computer world enhance writing or do something to writing, and that may be more significant than what it does to memory and orality? And she says, she predicts that the latter pair, memory and orality, will be more prominent as an effect of the new computer hyperlanguage. So she says, my idea is that being verbally vocal visual tools, the probe substance, or McLuhan's probes, is closer to the latter pair, memory and orality, even though their function might recall the one offered by links in hypertext, even though it seems to be about connecting meaning like writing does.
Hmm. Well, I still don't really get it.
She says, if my parallel stands, then the memex is to memory as writing is to orality. So writing altered the oral condition 2,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Memex is going to alter our memory more than anything else. Not our writing ability. It's going to have a bigger effect on our memory and orality.
Because writing is already obsolete.
Yes, but people think hypertext is writing, but a multi-level writing.
But they're not doing the writing. They're just doing the clicking.
Yeah, but the people who design them have to know how to do it, and people can learn how to make hypertext.
Right, but no, it's still, writing is obsolete, and now they're making memory obsolete, is what I see.
Well, it's not just obsolete, it extends it. Let's read the next paragraph, maybe she explains it.
Okay.
We can certainly read the mosaic, McLuhan's mosaic, as a hypertext if we work out the parallel at a general level, focusing, for instance, on our mode of fruition. Each probe in the text, be it a quotation, a provocative question, an image, or an aphorism, could be conceived as a window opening on a series of more complex ideas that readers decide to disregard or explore. That's the hyperlinking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? More options of how to read what's given. Readers must therefore decide which paths to take in the exploration, whether to open one window page after the other or move backward and forward across them, or whether to navigate the hypertext following the menu or to proceed freely through it, you know, picking out your own path.
Mm-hmm.
Readers create their interactive reading patterns. Now, you don't do that when you get a passive package called a book.
Mm-hmm.
You follow what it shows you.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have all kinds of options, so it's interactive. So it's called intertextuality, which is a clear feature of hypertext and of McLuhan's mosaic. McLuhan wanted you to participate in his meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And so this participatory form of reading takes us inside and outside both structures at once, suggesting hyperlinks to various inner and outer landscapes. The condensed probes of McLuhan's mosaic seem a particularly apt form also for hypertext, as brevity is what makes electric communication more efficacious. So she's saying that McLuhan's mosaic presentation of information is so timely and resonant with the new environment of hypertext.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that how that affects movement and all the other senses, orality and visual writing, is what she's trying to pin down here, which gets influenced more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now she's going to quote Sobelman, so let's jump to that sentence, a few lines down.
Yeah.
As Sobelman noticed, McLuhan developed the idea of interface in relation to cultural processes, interface being the meeting of structures or cultures or conflicting technologies and the way they change each other. In other words, the term interface, which is currently used in information and communication technologies, is associated by the Canadian thinker with a hybrid, the meeting of two or more media or cultural situations / processes inside a given environment, as well as to the new structural forms which originate from such hybridization, So it's kind of repetitious of what we've learned already.
Yeah, and Sobelman is her mentor.
Yeah, so she had to quote him. So it's all just interfacing. We know all that. So let's just go to the next subheading, de-hypertexting the mosaic.
Now it gets into my friend and your friend, Michelle Mose.
Yeah.
She spells it wrong. She has Michael. It's actually M-I-C-H-E-L, not A-E-L.
Michelle.
And he is a Trontonian whose father was a friend of McLuhan's. Mm-hmm. His father ran some art gallery or something in the art world of Toronto. And McLuhan wrote a foreword for one of the books that Michelle's father put out, I think on Carol Appel. Anyways, Mikkel, as a boy, would see McLuhan in his home occasionally because they lived near Wychwood Park, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So he went on to Oxford as a student and studied, I think, medieval stuff, and he really stood out. But then when he wrote his PhD, his professor showed no interest in it, and he didn't even know if the professor read it.
Mm.
So Michelle, after putting out a good book of McLuhan obscure interviews and articles in the late 90s, 96, 97, he wrote this essay, which about hypertext in a different way than anybody else did, and Lamberti is very impressed with what Mose did.
Mm-hmm.
But Mose got fed up with academic life, and he quit, and he works, I think, in the computer world now. But he was disillusioned at the superficiality of PhD life.
Right.
But he wrote a very important essay that Lamberti uses to understand hypertext.
Right. Okay. And she says,
do you remember when we met with him in New York one day?
Sure.
At his father's studio in
that
New York City?
That I remember. Because
yeah.
He was a handsome young man.
Yes.
That I remember.
Yes, I never dared to leave the room. Leaving you two alone, that would have been a big mistake.
It is a brilliant essay.
And you know, his mm-hmm. present girlfriend, partner, I don't know what the relationship is, they called in maybe before 2012,
mm-hmm.
Maybe 2014, but they called in and his Russian girlfriend had a long talk with Ion.
Oh.
But they never called back.
Uh-huh. So, De-Hypertexting the Mosaic. It is a brilliant essay by Michelle Mose, which offers the ground for new interpretations of McLuhan's mosaic. As the North American critic suggests that, more than a hypertext, the mosaic appears, in fact, as a hyperlanguage. In his, quote, the hypertext heuristic, McLuhan probes tested, bracket, a case for edible spaceships, bracket, unquote, Mose traces the origins of the hypertext heuristic as well as the connections between the heuristic and new literary theories developed in the late 20th century, as previously mentioned. Bush's idea of the memex, Nelson's concept of hypertext, Barth's Alexia, Foucault's textual strategies, and Landau's convergence of critical theory and technology are discussed here. While so doing, Mose detects an interesting aporia, which is crucial to our discussion of the humanistic substance of McLuhan's electric mosaic. What's aporia?
I think it's a puzzle. Can you just check that?
I'll look it up.
Yeah, the Bush Barthes, famous French philosopher, they often call him the McLuhan of France, Roland Barthes. Foucault is another French thinker. And Landau was the guy we were talking about earlier around metaphor, and he was talking about the Finneganese of language without mentioning Finnegans Wake. All these guys are part of the academic routine in the 80s and 90s. It's people that professors would teach. So Mose is taking what he had to learn, teachers he had to respect and study, and showing McLuhan got there before them, and they actually don't interpret hypertext correctly. McLuhan does. Wow. They don't.
Right. So aporia is an irresolvable internal contradiction or logical disjunction in a text, argument, or theory.
Right.
And heuristic, I looked that up, to enabling a person to discover or learn something for themselves, which is sort of McLuhan's method all along.
Yeah, it's a teaching tool. Mm. Heuristics are teaching methods.
Yeah. Okay, so there's Mose.
Okay, so now we have to read this quote, which I'm going to read.
Okay.
The difficult point.
Whose quote is it?
This is Mikhail Moses' quote.
Okay.
Let me just check that, just in case.
Yeah,
and you know his essay is called "The Hypertext Heuristic" or the "How the Hypertext is a Teaching Tool."
Mm-hmm.
Subtitle: McLuhan Probes Tested. So McLuhan got there first, and then this new hypertext teaching method is going to be redoing McLuhan, whether they know it or not. And then he puts in brackets a case for edible spaceships. Edible spaceships is a term phrase in understanding media that not many people notice. Back then, I used to point out to people, McLuhan said, in the future, spaceships would be edible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that mean? What's an edible spaceship? So Michelle, being a good McLuhan scholar, noticed that phrase and put it into his intriguing title.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, talking about McLuhan and hypertext and new technology, on one hand, the idea that with hypertext one now has a means of testing postmodern theory remains precisely that. So hypertext proves all this McLuhan derivative thinking coming out of France in the postmodern world that failed to notice it was thinning its wake, but they are seeing the multilinearity of hypertext, and so they made new theories of how to write and how to react to your public. So you have a means of testing postmodern theory with hypertext until one actually has the specimen in question. Either an adequate hypertext interface or at least a writing sample that embodies the requisite tropes of interactivity. It is the opposite of the position the software pirate often finds himself in. That is, we have the manual but not the actual program it refers to. So this is pretty hard to follow when you're listening, these sentences. So if you're not getting this, don't worry, we're not getting it either. So then the second paragraph, Moose writes, on the other hand, to the extent that the web instantiates hypertext, it must be noted that this is a distributed hypertext. The original problems, those of compression and selection across a wide field of available data, have not been solved. For the solitary user, the World Wide Web exists as a relatively untapped pool of hyperpotential awaiting the powerful thrust of browsers and the torque search engines of an organizing intelligence. So he's basically saying, if you don't know McLuhan, you don't know how to take advantage of the new technical language of hypertext. Okay?
Uh-huh.
If you try to relate it to postmodern theory, that might be useful, but it doesn't tell you how to use it in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he's sort of saying here. You've got the manual, the postmodern people laid out the theory that hypertext matches, but they don't know how to do something with it. They don't know it's already been done by Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan's way of writing. The way to apply hypertext or to make your interesting, take advantage of the services of hypertext is to do what McLuhan did. And these thinkers don't know that.
And I'm sure Michelle talked about Finnegan's Wake because I think that's the way to define hypertext. It's
okay, here's where he's going to try to do that.
Okay.
So he's saying this problem of hypertext's untapped pool of hyperpotential awaiting the powerful thrust of browsers and the torque search engines of an organizing intelligence. It is an idea which also connects, says Mikhail, to McLuhan's idea of organized ignorance.
I think this is Lamberti talking.
Yes, no, but she's translating what
okay.
Moses is saying.
Right.
She's very impressed with this idea that he is saying, because he's going to promote McLuhan in relation to these other fuddy-duddies, okay? It is an idea which also connects to McLuhan's idea of organized ignorance, an overload of information which we still do not know how to master except by trusting a more or less recognizable intelligence which can organize it for us. Organized ignorance is conducive to a conservative attitude towards knowledge, which ends by blocking progress. McLuhan insists that previous knowledge is what tends to be preserved when you look at new things for new keys. It is knowledge that creates real ignorance, just as wealth creates poverty. Organized ignorance is presented, she says, as a way of bypassing the problem of knowledge as confusion and as blocked discovery. Mm-hmm. So she's saying that most realizes McLuhan figured out how to take advantage of this.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this idea relates to King Thamus' interpretation of a new technology as a threat to traditional wisdom, something which encourages recollection instead of memory, which in an oral society, and also in a post-oral society, is understood as the key to knowledge and wisdom, and creates addiction to external devices or matrices. And where there are devices and matrices, there are engineers and masterminds. Someone is there to design a ground for the user to use, a system of preconceived signs and codes inside which each user can search for an individual path. In other words, there is always an organizing intelligence to organize ignorance, which might then appear as a visible result of a hidden pattern of forces of which users are not always aware.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if anybody could follow what we're saying here. This is maybe one of the most complex points in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So then she says, this situation...
But I think people realize how intricate Finnegan's Wake is, and we're just saying hypertext is like a modern Finnegan's Wake. What more can you say?
Well, she tries to. She says, to respond to the above-mentioned mystery, she's laying out the mysteries of what the meaning of hypertext is, to respond to these aporia, Most introduces some interesting considerations on McLuhan's mosaic and proposes to invert the process of hypertext construction. Okay? He's going to do something different. Instead of using the screen as an interface, we can use McLuhan's pages as the interface on which we can plug other media, thereby verifying how the heuristic underpinning of the electronic, or now digital, hypertext could eventually be applied to McLuhan's form of writing. So we're going to use hypertext to develop new ways of reading and writing and miss the fact that the way to do to use hypertext to our advantage was already done by McLuhan's method of writing.
Hmm.
She says, the goal is to test the explorative potentialities offered by the mosaic. And then she quotes most about McLuhan. McLuhan shows how you can take the low-tech interface of the page and reverse engineer it so it can handle other inputs so that you can, in effect, plug other media into it.
Hmm.
End of quote. Then she says, in this hypothesis, McLuhan's glosses are considered as adapter cables which activate interfacing, juxtaposing different media on what stays as a text-based operating system. The form book is renewed through the contact with the diverse and discontinuous life forms, at the same time revealing a new exploratory technique. So McLuhan's goal was to make the book relevant to the new technical world that obsolesced the book.
Wow.
And Moose understands that McLuhan, picking up from Finney's Wake, finds a way to apply hypertext and its advantages in book form, therefore preserving the book as relevant to how to explore the hypertext world better than hypertext offered.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you really got to understand McLuhan and Finney's Wake to understand what I just said.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty good on Lamberti's point that she understands this is what McLuhan has done,
mm-hmm.
and she got it from a close reading of Mikhail Most. So Most makes the important insight. It's an excellent scholarly application of McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
So Most says, the structure of McLuhan's analysis can answer what critical theory looks and feels like in hypertext, what it is like to think critically in a hypertextual mode. So how to be critical in a hypertextual mode, McLuhan already did it.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan, says Most, not only considers the multi-layered prose as serious art form, but a necessary mutation if cultural criticism is to keep pace with the increasing complexity of the objects it purports to describe. In other words, to keep up with the effects of hypertext and not get and the user getting lost, you got to use McLuhan as a training in perception, which nobody realized. That McLuhan was going to be an answer to what technologies that were coming.
Yeah, so all this is pretty impossible. People aren't going to read enough McLuhan to follow him, to understand him. So the question is, how are people using hypertext? They're just using it as another clickbait.
Right.
Clickbait.
Let's see if she says something like that. In other words, yes, how to have a critical perspective on hypertext's effects. McLuhan figured out how to do that. And these other guys just state the problem. You have to realize, even in the 80s and 90s, they wouldn't teach McLuhan until Wired brought back McLuhan in 93 and started to make him famous again. McLuhan as the answer was not seen by anybody back in the day.
No, and nobody's going to stop to read them now. They're all vaping.
That's right. And so, let's see. So here's how McLuhan kind of jumped into and got this through his studies of Julian James's bicameral brain structures. So Lamberti says, after all, it is the human brain with its ability to associate simultaneous and inclusive events and to keep images and situations in mind and retrieve them in renewed context that is offered the ideal model for hypertext. The human brain is the ideal model of what hypertext is doing. By combining the new studies, so McLuhan studies the brain. By combining the new studies of the bicameral brain structures with his humanistic knowledge, McLuhan could thus elaborate his mosaic as an inclusive and simultaneous form of writing which optimizes language on the page with better compression techniques, enlarged memory storage, and enhanced program logic. Finnegan's Wake outdoes computers, thereby overcoming linearity and opening the phonetic form, the book, to new potentialities, which Joyce had done. It is for this reason that the mosaic can be retrieved as the objective correlative of a new cultural and critical discourse, more in tune with the electric environment than other later discourses. All the old POMO, postmodern guys, with their faulty, incomplete understandings, never have bettered McLuhan.
Put your mic down more towards your chin. So what I get from this is people can't imagine their brain can do this, so they're waiting for robots to do it. They really aren't going to...
Or getting obsessed and trying it themselves and taking vaping drugs to keep up with the the psychedelic
or
effect
Adderall.
Of... The psychedelic content effect of of hypertext. Now, here's the point. Lamberti, as a humanist, a literary humanist, is really happy to celebrate a guy who preserves the book form and humanist studies against this new flood of apocalyptic disruption.
Right.
So he created an objective correlative or a new medium of a new cultural and critical discourse. So then she says, the mosaic is therefore based... Now, you notice we're saying stuff here that isn't said in the other parts of the book. She's come to a new point in the book where something new is being said, and you can't say if she's just repeating herself. Her goals are the same, but she's tackling a relevant thing, somebody close to Dobbstown. As a matter of fact, when Michelle published this essay, or some variant of it, because he spoke at the McLuhan Symposium in March 1998, he put me in the credits. He acknowledged learning something from me in the printed version of his lecture. And that book comes out in 2005, 7 years after the conference. And my essay's in there, and Lance Straight had to fight off other people to even allow me to be in there. But whoever was editing it would not allow my name to be in there. So either he refused to have it in there, or he reluctantly had it deleted, but then he said goodbye to those people. So he quit academia again after leaving Oxford. And so Lamberti is celebrating a guy who was influenced by Dobbstown. Okay. And that's not allowed to be uttered in academia.
Another lie.
Right. So the McLuhan Mosaic, she says, you know, explaining Michomos, the mosaic is therefore based on an idea of interface, which is supposed to be the new glorious abilities of two-way communication through computers. So an idea of interface, which McLuhan had already started to conceptualize in his introduction to The Bias of Communication, Harold Innes' most celebrated volume, when commenting not only on his colleagues, Innes' ideas, but also on his language. In particular, interface is presented as a structural component of Innes' investigative methodology, as McLuhan underlines how Innes places his insights in a mosaic structure of seemingly unrelated and disproportionate sentences and aphorisms. McLuhan also notices how Innes' writing generates insights by the method of interface. If you look up in whatever kind of dictionary acknowledges this, McLuhan is the first person to use the word interface. I think she cites that earlier. Maybe even Sobelman points that out. But here he is using this word, you know, 50 years ago. So she says, McLuhan points out the lack of connectives in favor of a peritactic technique or a mosaic or parallel collage effect, like Finnegan's Wake, is the reality computers are bringing in, or hypertext. So he already was a master of collage. McLuhan points out the lack of connectives in favor, you know, you don't want to make two linear connections, in favor of a peritactic or paralleling technique, which turns Innes' written page into an interface. So he's saying that McLuhan recognized that Innes had discovered a new way of writing without knowing about Finnegan's Wake in that. He stumbled on it, and McLuhan praises Innes for doing that, and then McLuhan does it better than Innes. But Innes was the first to write in scholarly books that were rejected by his colleagues because they were in this peritactic juxtaposed style rather than linear dialectical logic. So his page, Innes' written page, reflecting the natural form of conversation or dialogue rather than of written discourse. So a lot of modernist work, or the vorticist work, Pound, Joyce, Eliot, is that they brought in the orality, the conversational nature of communication into their artworks. That was seen as a major characteristic of modernism. Or vorticism. Okay, let's see.
Now, the next whole half page is repetition, but I pick it up just above the next quote about the hybrid, where she says, the new hybrid energy derived from the cross-pollination of different media is what encourages new epiphanies precisely because of the new form that it creates, characterized by an extraordinary intensity. So, whereas before she talked about cross-pollination, I don't know if she used that word. I don't know if she used hybrid before, but...
Yeah, she did.
Yeah, that she's repeating now what the consequence of the hypertext business. The next...
So let me read something about that.
Okay.
She's talking about the meeting of media, the hybridization. And then she says, the form of McLuhan's mosaic, then, is born out of the meeting of orality and literacy. There's cross-pollination. And the resulting extraordinary intensity snaps us out of the narcissism and narcosis imposed on our senses, our hypnotism, by the mechanicity of literacy. This form certainly anticipates later forms of communication, such as hypertext. And as previously said, it certainly shares similar tenets to hypertext itself in structure, i.e. the analogical combination of probes and textual fragments, and in modes of fruition, for example, the possibility to freely move backward and forward inside the text. So this new freedom to read, like Finnegan's Wake trains you to do, McLuhan creates a style of doing that and prepares us for hypertext. So people are discovering with hypertext that, oh, I can read on a multiple level, multilinearity, jump from area to area.
Yeah, I can go anywhere in McLuhan's book and get some ideas. There's no storyline. There's no novelization at all.
That's what they learned from hypertext, and Moose is pointing out that this was already prepared for you by McLuhan's adaptation.
Yeah.
Adaptation of Finnegan's Wake.
Right. Okay. And at the bottom of
here's the McLuhan point.
Yes.
She says, but as a form, it is meaningfully different because it is rooted in the ancient liberal art of grammar. This is something that today hypertext does not necessarily imply.
Uh-huh.
So McLuhan gives a history of the form. Hypertext doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, you go. Where do we go next?
Toward the end of the middle of the next paragraph, she picks up on Mose again. Do you see that?
Yeah.
Mose rightly recalls the great concept of portability of thought based on an internal mobility of language through which thought itself advances. I mean, there's some smart words there. What do they mean, Bob?
Well, in my in-depth discussions and arguments with Ion about what's thought and what's brain and what's mind and what's the layers of pathways in the brain, this is the kind of sentence I'd end up saying with Ion. You know, language was the tunnel through which thought itself advanced.
Hmm.
And then you try to figure out what's the difference between thought and the tunnel or the brain paths. So that's why that is a familiar sentence. The portability of thought. Let's see. McLuhan's method relies on the witty power of puns and words to perceive analogies between apparently unrelated things. Just take that point, that McLuhan related things that weren't obviously to be related.
Yeah.
And the new user of hypertext in the 90s stumbles into connections that hypertext leads them to. So he says, oh, I didn't know you could connect to that.
Mm.
So the experience of connecting in strange ways that normal linear thinking would not prepare you for, Lamberti's saying McLuhan already trained you on that.
Mm-hmm.
So then she says, McLuhan's mosaic opens windows to unpack all the compressed learning. Think of the 60 languages compressed on each page of Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
So McLuhan quotes Bacon and his 19th century commentators, and then Moose repeats McLuhan's method of quoting Francis Bacon from the 1600s and relating it to 19th century writers. Moose rightly recalls a great concept of portability of thought based on an internal mobility of language through which thought itself advances. Then Lamberti says, such a concept is also assessed in relation to McLuhan's study of Harold Innes' language, where McLuhan defines each of Innes' sentences as a compressed monograph.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan says, Innes includes a small library on each page, much like Finnegan's Wake, and often incorporates a small library of references on the same page in addition. So if you look at a modern page with computers, you look at all the blued out words, you know, the underlined words that indicate hypertext. You could spend 2 days on one page following the links, because they're going to go to other places that are going to have other links.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a real endless quest. All that is implied in the way Innes writes, who was a student of Wyndham Lewis, and McLuhan writes, right? Consequently, says Lamberti, reading becomes an active process, not simply because it enables us to understand what is written in the book and to participate in the creation of meaning, but mostly because it encourages us to continue exploring. And if we fully engage in that form, it will further foster knowledge.
Yeah.
Now, I just heard a click. We might have been disconnected.
Uh-huh. So go on the chat and see if we're still on.
Yeah, see if, it'll start beeping if we're disconnected, but I will just see what's here.
Type in.
No, what I do is I Fred, can you hear us? Or Susanna, can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, we didn't get disconnected. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so back to...
And it's just a couple more pages.
Okay, where were we? We were just reading about Innes, and
He was creating hypertext without having a clue what he was doing, it sounded like. But he must have had a clue.
Well, he didn't know he was creating hypertext.
No.
Consequently, reading becomes an active process, not simply because it enables us to understand what is written in the book and to participate in the creation of meaning, but mostly because it encourages us to continue exploring. And if we fully engage in that form, it will further foster knowledge. That's why McLuhan ends one of his books as, there is no finish line. Mm-hmm. Just like there's no finish line or even a period in Finnegan's Wake. Mm-hmm. So the endless exploring and teasing of the mind is what the electric age is going to bring in.
You mean there's no period at the end of Finnegan's Wake?
Right. So It's science was making progress with a goal, and they hope to get some integrated, or like Stephen Hawking, theory of everything,
mm-hmm.
you know, some big unified situation. Conceptually, that, as we get more and more into the computer age, is not seen as a realistic goal in knowledge, to come to a conclusion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this is partly why in medicine, the authorities, the AMA, look down on any quack, someone they consider a quack, because they claim they've solved some medical issue.
Yeah.
They've come up with a cure.
Yeah.
And they always rely on that insight, or just the natural effect of living in the modern world, in modern medicine, knowing that there's endlessly new products and new effects and new disservices and side effects, this endless correcting, and not really achieving a goal. For example, Wall Street says, it wouldn't be good to come up with a cure for cancer, because
mm-hmm.
that would disrupt the endless processing of the English, of the information environment.
Yep.
We live endless process every day, new recyclings and new variations of information for our dangling ganglia.
Mm-hmm.
So process takes over from replaces product or completion.
Mm-hmm.
Now this drives most people nuts that we don't get to any stopping point.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the nature of knowledge today, and this is what hypertext is an example of.
But that's a Taoist philosophy. Remember the Taoist priest that I worked with on the Chinese diet book? He could never make a decision about anything because he knew everything would be incomplete.
Right, so he was numbed by the incompletion of things. He then was further numbed by the fact we externalized this technologically, this mm-hmm. incomplete processing or endless processing has now become a big part of the economy and all its
mm-hmm.
product creators.
Mm-hmm.
And not knowing how to stop in relation to that is the crisis for people.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan provided a way to stop, to understand the processual processing constantly going on, but how to get perspective on it. He offered perspective, and he felt Joyce had figured it out. So Joyce presented this infinite processing in the book. That was the content of the book, but he froze it in the book form to
mm-hmm.
show you
mm-hmm.
the figure of processing and the ground it comes from.
Right.
So that's a pretty metaphysical accomplishment by Joyce, and pretty smart of McLuhan to figure that out. So when Lamberti says we're going to learn to continue and have endless participatory exploring, here we are in 2018, 40 years later, and society is sick of endless exploring and global disintegration and global melting, and they want someone to stop this and take a stance, and that's Trumpism.
Mm.
You know, to stop the dismantling of the visual boundaries of the United States
mm-hmm.
or of the West, and to create a wall, reestablish a wall, which is pretty hard to do under this electronic inevitability of it, no finish line,
right.
You know. But it's a mood felt by people, and so they're saying rebuild walls everywhere. So we can take a break from endlessly processing information that goes nowhere. Because most people aren't trained in these strategies. They don't go to university. They don't get it in university. If they do, they don't have this perception training that we and ION offer, in my watered-down post-McLuhanism. We offer ways to the average person who hasn't got time or feels don't have time to study this book and to figure these things out. They're just lost in the sea.
But what happened in the world has nothing to do with universities or even philosophy. It was a globalist agenda brought up by the electronic environment, because everybody was told that we are all one, so we have to have a globalist policy. We have to have a one-world government. Everybody has to eat the same crap, do the same thing, have the same little car. And that's, I don't even know if people realize that's what was happening to the world. And all the trade agreements and everything was to bring everything down to the lowest common denominator.
Did you know that that started in the 30s? It was called internationalism.
Okay.
Yeah. You knew that?
I can imagine. I mean, I know.
The radio era brought it in. So you have this lingering radio effect, and then translating to TV and computers in the early areas. But they didn't see the decentralizing effect of electric media. So Hitler tries to take over the world, but he's up against his colleagues and generals who are creating their own separate tribes from him, like the mafia, fragmenting and breaking their own little power empires and mini-states. That decentralization undermines the globalist agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So Trump is not retrieving national identity based on the old print boundaries. He is decentralizing from the Web 2.0 world via Twitter. He's a Twitter nation.
Mm-hmm.
He's creating a separation, because he can, from the global mishmash. So the globalists are trying to integrate what has long been integrated and can't get integrated anymore, but the globalists project their literate hierarchy on the situation and think that they are the top of a pile,
mm-hmm.
or the top of a status meritocracy. And that doesn't work either.
Nope.
See, so the images of world government don't apply to today.
And maybe that's the next subsection, and we'll wrap up with this electrifying hybrid.
Well, wait a minute. I want to find this. But just before let me just read this quote from McLuhan. It's pretty good for the wrap up the point I was trying to make.
Okay.
Okay, this is note 22. This is from McLuhan. So McLuhan says, the effect is to enable those very functions. No, that's...
I'll look up 22.
No, it is McLuhan.
No, it's Mose. The hypertext.
Oh, the sub-quote is McLuhan. Okay, mm-hmm. So the first part is most. The effect is to enable those very functions computer hypertext regards as a constitutive, yet still strives to define. What is it that they are doing? Integration of the reader into the writing process and real-time access to the archive.
Mm-hmm.
So the effect is enable those very functions computer hypertext regards as a constitutive, yet still strives to define, namely, integration of the reader into the writing process and real-time access to the archive. Thus, Innes, and then he quotes McLuhan, expects the reader to make discovery after discovery that he himself had missed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the positive part of the electronic global theater in the 60s. Everybody gets in the act. Everybody can help create the global information syndrome.
And that's a hypertext function as well.
Well, people were hypertexting before hypertext showed up 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the Android meme replaying the participation of the global theater.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened is that was pushed to extreme, and now people are exhausted with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so Trump appears to be, as Alex Jones says, against the globalists. Well, Trump is the chip body going around the old TV body. The TV body was the integrative, participatory, global situation, global village. That was the ideology. But the decentralizing chip body undermined that.
Mm-hmm.
So then Lamberti says, the act of reading the mosaic, then, is envisaged as an experience which enhances the process of construction of knowledge, as well as a process of actualization of a knowledge elaborated through time and space. It is that very process of actualization which awakens readers from the narcissist narcosis effect. The mosaic, as the form which embeds and allows such an experience, is a cold medium, or a truly tactile one, because it forces the reader to compensate for what is not obvious in the text, but which is nevertheless present and compressed in a probe or in a pun. The portability of thought, so translated, is what makes the mosaic a hyperlanguage more than a hypertext. After all, language is an oral acoustic concept, and text is a linear one with all it implies in terms of sensorial awareness and active participation. That's a bit sort of old fogey talk there. But this is pointing to the obsolescence of McLuhan.
Mm.
McLuhan is encouraging this participatory engagement by the reader, the consumer, which runs its course the last few years and flips into appearing to be a huge disservice.
Uh-huh.
But the Android meme carries on the process regardless of humans' opinions about it,
mm-hmm,
and humans' fatigue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, in the next section, electrifying hybrid, go about 8 lines down on the page 117, 118. McLuhan's mosaic could be defined as the LSD of post-secondary orality readers. It triggers inner trips, which in fact enlighten on cultural and media processes. Also, it forces us to inquire farther, to explore old and new knowledge, old and new books, ideas, visions. To hazard a parallel, which I'm sure will irritate most fans of hypertext, the mosaic retrieves an encyclopedic learning, while hypertext relies more on a reader's digest approach to knowledge. So I think that kind of sums up.
Well, what happens, though, is this is irrelevant to the endless processing that the Android meme provides, and people are forced to be subjected to in many ways through all their different media diets. It leads to 17-year-olds smoking DMT to keep up with the image stimulation that's all around them,
mm-hmm,
and to actually develop a wall or a numbness to it.
Mm-hmm.
But remember that the journalists couldn't believe that kids in high school were smoking, a very powerful drug,
yeah,
DMT.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because the journalist doesn't see that's the way the Android meme became,
mm-hmm,
hyper-DMT, in multiple levels of analog media. That is just too stressful for people. But the young kids, they got to grow up in it, so they take their drugs to keep used to it.
That's why speed is used for ADHD kids who we think are too sped up. So they take a drug just to match who they are.
And that was, McLuhan was the first to pick him up on that. He said people were taking LSD and psychedelics and maybe heroin to keep up with the global theater's processing of endless information and endless discovery, endless pattern recognition. McLuhan, and by the 70s, was saying, we're getting seduced by the cognitive thrills of excessive pattern recognition.
Mm-hmm.
This level, Lamberti doesn't get to.
Mm-hmm.
Lamberti doesn't get to the disservice that McLuhan saw of the new. And
well, she's calling it an LSD, a post-secondary orality. I mean, she's kind of...
Yeah, but she doesn't... She's celebrating McLuhan's books as sort of keeping up with what was going on in the Android meme and the global theater.
Mm.
Okay? But she doesn't see that mosaic is useless at this stage, 50 years later.
Okay. Yeah.
Because she wants to keep teaching her book world.
Mm-hmm.
She cannot give up the book.
Mm-hmm.
Remember what Cosmic Awareness said back in the 60s? I always remember this. They said, abandon the book.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
Yeah. And that's very hard for the West to do. And then the hyper-tactility of this endless processing threatens the tactile cultures, so they run to the book, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's the East coming to the West universities.
Mm-hmm. Sand and the creeping meatball.
Right.
That's the one I know.
Well, that's our crumb. And the creeping meatball, it's not an adequate term for the Android meme.
Mm-hmm.
It's an abandon the LSD trip.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan's mosaic could be defined as the LSD of post-secondary orality. So secondary orality is what McLuhan's student Walter Ong called the content of radio. So post-secondary orality is tactility, secondary tactility maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It triggers inner trips, which in fact enlighten on cultural and media processes. That's what his LSD does. Also, it forces us to inquire farther, to explore old and new knowledge, old and new books, ideas, and visions. You can see that the baby boomers and the Generation X and Generation Y, they all probably earlier get to a freak-out position where they have to have burnout. You as a doctor saw the burnout happening in the 80s to the baby boomers.
Right.
The burnout of this situation is what McLuhan warned about. He said we wouldn't be able to live in the 21st century at the speeds it's going to impose on us. But you see, Lemberti is talking about the usefulness of McLuhan to counter the people who come after McLuhan, who are either celebrating or warning and repeating what McLuhan and James Joyce did.
Mm-hmm.
So she wants us to go back and understand McLuhan, but I don't know if it handles the present stresses on people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the rest is just some rehashing. Unless you see anything there that you want to read, I think we're done.
Okay, this thing about to hazard a parallel, which I'm sure will irritate most fans of hypertext, the mosaic retrieves an encyclopedic learning, while hypertext relies more on a Reader's Digest approach to knowledge. So,
mm-hmm.
What did McLuhan do? He had, I think, A Mechanical Bride. The New Yorker versus the Reader's Digest. That's what it was. So the sophisticates of New Yorker thought the Reader's Digest was too bland, the Reader's Digest reader. So the same put down here. So Lemberti, who's now writing novels about life in New York, is taking on the New Yorker snobbish attitude and putting down the Reader's Digest aspect. But she's saying Reader's Digest is a symbol of slow-witted movement is what hypertext is compared to McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not a – and now McLuhan wrote a whole satire of the New Yorker mentality years ago in the 40s. So she's then saying, no, I'm not making a judgment. This is not a way to bless one form or bless another, but simply a way to point out that they express a different type of authorship, imply a different type of audience, and even though they share similar reading techniques, they nevertheless induce a different form of participation and involvement. The way we tend to read hypertext is perhaps more comparable to zapping, whereby we can still acquire a sense of progressing in mapping actuality or a given field of investigation. If we apply the same zapping technique to McLuhan's mosaic, we can certainly have fun, but we do not have the same sense of accumulating knowledge. In order to fully appreciate what is hidden in McLuhan's verbi-vocal-visual language, we have to act as an interface ourselves. We are the effective terminal of the communicative process. Terminal is the pun on ending.
Mm-hmm.
I'm putting a pun in there. We are the effective endpoint of the communicative process. So then she says, now this is what's important. She's trying to explain Moose's point, how McLuhan somehow provides an antidote to the hypertext maelstrom. She says, an even bolder parallel would be between the way data are electronically moved and the way McLuhan's prose move inside the reader's heads. A message sent through the World Wide Web is decomposed into small units and bits which move independently across the various channels of the net. And once at their destination, they are recomposed on the receiver's screen and form a readable message. In a similar way, McLuhan's mosaic is received as a discontinuous and fragmented form whose smaller units are bits of a deeper train of thought continue to move inside the reader's brain. In time, they combine with new ones until they enlighten each other and spark knowledge. It is an effect linked to the above-mentioned concept of portability of thought, and which at the same time recalls the one suggested by T.S. Eliot in discussing the real use or meaning of poetry. which is, while diverting attention through content, the poem works upon readers through form. Readers and writing are therefore juxtaposed in a dynamic interplay, which could be understood as a crucial element capable of overcoming the finiteness of the printed page of books, because discontinuous writing acquires new meaning with each act of reading, depending on the reader. The pages of the electronic hypertext are virtually unlimited because they can be constantly updated and enriched by posting new data or new juxtapositions enhanced by readers themselves. However, that does not necessarily imply that what was there before, I'll read that again, however, that does not necessarily imply that what was there before stays forever visible or settles in the reader's mind. So that disservice of hypertext, she's going to say, McLuhan solves. So she says, the continuous renovation of hypertext is, in fact, more a matter of the quantity of posted data than of permanency or stability of knowledge. With McLuhan, in spite of the clear limit imposed by the printed page format, his mosaic renews at each reading, not because new data are added, but because what he writes resounds in a different way in the reader's minds.
Amen.
As effective terminal of the communication process, readers bring their renovating selves into each act of reading.
There you go.
So you make this endlessly changing hypertext thing in Finnegan's Wake is more effective than going into a literally various way of rabbit-holing yourself through hypertext links. All right? So then she says, the investigation operating on the old medium of writing is what helps to overcome the limits of the new one, as the former writing enables the retention of the intensity of the communication, the train of thought, that the electric media, which encourage speed and fast communication, do not always preserve and encourage. So somehow McLuhan gives an image of stoppability or perspective or in a way not so much consumption of new data, but sticking with the one book like I did and read it for 50 years over and over. Even though based on literacy, the low-tech interface, you know, a little paperback of McLuhan's Mosaic stands as a powerful technology for reenacting knowledge while preserving a tactile approach to memory. Through its verbo-vocal visuality, the Mosaic brings us in touch simultaneously. McLuhan brings us touch in touch simultaneously with both tradition and actuality and engages us in a continuous actualization of our probing and learning experience. You wish, Ms. Lamberti, you wish. The media fan is, in fact, a tricky, if not a false mask, which vanishes inside McLuhan's written corpus if you only take time to enter or access it. In other words, he's not a media fan, wholeheartedly. Now, I just want to look up the statement about McLuhan's masks. I should have it annotated in this book somewhere. Where did I put it? I'm just looking through my notes here. A page that lists all the four or five masks. Do you have a page for that? Let's see. I don't know why I didn't make a... I know I did, but how did I term it? Just a second. Got many notes here. Where she first mentions the mask. It must be in the first couple pages.
It would have to be.
Can you do your search?
I can, but I'll come up with a million masks.
Oh.
Different masks we put on. Okay, here. The media. I got it. Look at that. Four different masks. I'm on page 15.
Okay.
Unveiling four different masks that through time.
Okay, I have it, and I got to make a note of this.
Yeah.
In part one of this book, she says, the part called The Mosaic, I offer an investigation of McLuhan's form of writing, approached as a systemic cognitive tool through the unveiling of four different masks that through time we have put on Marshall McLuhan. The media oracle mask, that's the one we're missing. The media guru mask. The modernist, you know, neo-vorticist mask, and the media techno fan.
Okay.
So, right, I was saying oracle, no, I was saying mask, it was media oracle.
Okay.
So the four masks, oracle, guru, modernist, and fan. Okay, so that's good, page 15. All right, I'm ready to return. Well, let's open the gates. and see if there was any kind of participatory processing going on in our hypertext form of conversation.
And the next chapter is page 122.